morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Halfway through Kwanzaa, we are at the cuspidor of a new year, 2019, which is part of a still adolescent century and a baby millennium. A century ago, the world started the year 1919 after a horrific war that killed at least 10 million human beings and was cause and effect of an influenza pandemic that killed 100 million more all over the planet. So now we begin 2019 with a reality that each succeeding year will deplete the population who crossed the portal into this third millennium of what is now called the Common Era from the second millennium. By 2050, most of us second millennials will have vanished, as has everyone born before 1919. I start today's program with a reflection on the future that I wrote, or more truthfully, a patchwork mosaic of previous thoughts and ruminations I have scribbled over time. I call it, We Are the Millennium, and the Millennium is Us. Humanity's astute calculation of time might not fit any other world or plane of existence than our own, and even so is a compromise between observation and superstition. We who live our brief lives in the cosmic here and now are occupants of a bipartite era of centuries and millennia of our own counting. We are heirs of multi-millennia of our species and surge toward an unknown future in which we see ourselves opaquely in unfamiliar milieus. Our past seems like a huge junkyard filled with discarded and out-of-date debris of no use to present or future. Yet the past grips the present with an uneasy sense that we are being propelled uncontrollably, a fearful anticipation linked with numbness from too much change too quickly. Postmodern life is too complicated and frenzied, familiar guideposts constantly ripped away. Every life, rich or poor, is a Gordian knot. Our grim perception is that we have grievously injured our home planet and that the end of our history is approaching, that ancient apocalyptic prophecies are incited by doomsday weapons of our invention. We feel that we are out of phase, and we suspect that we have lost control or are out of control. We resist change, though it drags us along like a corpse. Change percolates chaos. It takes a long time to abandon obsolescent dogma and doctrine. Salvation of our bodies and presumed souls does not lie in elegant mythological sophistries, nor is ascension to Elysian clouds reward for a life spent on one's knees. We are at a point in our evolution in which we ought to realize that everything is in continual transition, that ideas and institutions change and wear away with the same cyclical constancy as mountain ranges and ocean waves. All that is major to our lives will wither and disappear, deconstructuring while under construction. And memory of us will as well fade, vaguely recalled nostalgically as we fog into obscurity. Time's impatient neuroses does not allow lingering, except in memory and perhaps personal and historic sentiment. Time seems in our short lives a linear presence in an elliptical universe, much as the near horizon seems flat on a large globe. Scarcely enough time to make oneself at home on the planet before we are evicted. The ineffable enigma, is this the only appearance we make as ourselves in the universe? Time cannot be held even as long as a breath. Our corroding hearts keep time for us, ticking each hemosecond that perfuses into yester pulsus. Gravity nails our flesh to earth, yet spins our blood for balance through spheres of our brains on a perpetual edge of the present. Instants swarm at us like particles and protons, or like locusts flailing at us, wearing us away. We bring to each instant a baggage of tradition and experience, and a worry about death. We grasp each passing moment, impose our simultaneity on it, and reel into the next. Every moment is new, like waves from an immense ocean, each second an uncertainty unexplored and doubtful, and is instantly history, unretrievable except in memory and myth. The fabrics of human themes are woven from billions of diverse threads that dissolve into everybody, moving in confused randomness with seemingly no discernible purpose as they bump into each other. Just quantum aggregates of ordinary persons doing their own thing as they flounder through time, swarming like protozoa in a drop of water. Relatively soon, our swiftly transient portion of the human narrative will be the remote past. Each day is a rebirth, but also a day closer to the crypt. Death is life's price, and the contemporary world we live in will be as much artifact as Paleolithic bones. Boiling history to the bone might be as easy as an X-ray as it recedes into an ever remoter past. Yet the bone-bare facts are superimposed with flesh, muscle, and fat of varying colors, textures, and striations. Events and personalities that occupy a certain period diminish to mere footnotes or are forgotten altogether. In general, the episodes and names that survive future erasure remain as symbols of stark or sculptural simplicities. We are wrong to think of early civilizations and the people who built them as anciently fossilized, dead and disappeared from any relevance. They are instead the youth of our species, vigorous, wildly imaginative, avaricious, and violent. We are what they bequeathed us, an inseparable thread of our maturation. Rather than regard our ancestors as ancient, mummified gray heads, we ought to regard them as precocious neophytes in the nursery of our history. We are the old ones. We are born and live much later in Earth's age than our predecessors, whose brilliant and inspired youth constructed our own venerable mid-evolution crises. We too often scorn them as naive and primitive compared to our post-modernity and sophistication. We forget what they learned for us. Younger generations always think they are pioneers of new futures, yet they are later evolutions of our aging species, actually older in time than their parents the instant they are born. Our successors will most likely revile us with an identical patronizing contempt, if they think of us at all, as they hasten to their own oblivions and replacement until at last our self-designed species, Homo sapiens, man the wise, quote unquote, perishes like trilobites and dodo birds. If human intelligence does not entirely destroy Earth, perhaps another sentient species might reach out to fill the vacuum. Maybe not. Numerous sentient humans perceive that human life and possibly all organic existence is conceivably so rare in the universe that its loss as a result of parochial conflicts over abstract principles or despotic ambitions peculiar to a point in time would be immensely more intolerable than the eclipse of axioms or aspirations, which human in origin would surely be evaporated in the Holocaust. It should seem imperative that we realize our insensate aggression and misguided prejudices will probably obliterate us and remove our species from a history we are only beginning to comprehend. By not confronting our intrinsic duality, we truly subvert to Homo un or non-sapiens. A paradox that underlies our history is that the eras of greatest creativity and discovery are also the most dangerous, not least because they adversely incorporate intellectual reversion and savage descent to ignorance and intolerance, which generally coexist within every renaissance, but not always given the forum or respect of recent years. We ought to pay attention to consequences. We cannot afford any longer to blur or fake truth, nor approach hard realities obliquely. It is necessary that we accept responsibility for the ravaging of our home planet and for the enormous contradictions between wealth and poverty and the abhorrent inequality they perpetuate rigorously worldwide. We might try to listen to quieter voices we seldom hear over the angry and anguished uproar. Underneath the meanness and bellicosity that signify regression and repression is a plea to slow down the cruel-hearted lunge of political and cultural dystopia. These quieter voices, usually friendly and sane, guarantee difficult times ahead and warn us that we need each other to get there from here. We are alone in the dark, and each of us will inescapably die. Yet we must struggle through the adversity and troublous retrogression, or perish as a people not worthy or deserving to inhabit planet Gaia. We imperil the future when we lose faith in it. We endanger our descendants when we try to hide our evasive lives in vanished worlds of our predecessors. No single human can avoid death by retreating into a personal past, nor can a society survive through empty homage to a fancied simpler period or more glorious age. Romanticizing the past inhibits insights that our ancestors and their histories provide and dissolves the strength of will and brain fertility necessary to converge with the future. It really makes little sense to fear the future. It is, after all, where we will spend the rest of our lives. Arthur Rimbaud wrote, "At dawn, armed with burning patience, we shall enter splendid cities." And Samuel Beckett, "You must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on." And that was something I wrote. We are the millennium, and the millennium is us. And now, I have two by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. I start the first one, Stealing the Spoons. Our 26th and youngest president merits my great respect. Theodore Roosevelt used his bully pulpit to promote conservation, the creation of national parks and monuments, railroad regulation, trust busting, pure food and drug legislation, and a square deal for all. Impressive though that may be, T.R., winner of the 1906 Nobel Peace Prize, was also the rough rider who shouted, "Holy Godfrey, what fun," during the Battle of San Juan Hill in the Spanish-American War, and emerged as a major advocate of American imperialism. Looking back at our evolving commitment to imperialism, extending a country's power and influence through diplomacy or military force, I am reminded that the expansion of America at home and abroad was not a new idea in 1898. Howard Zinn, American historian and author of A People's History of the United States, noted, quote, "Even before the war against Mexico carried the United States to the Pacific, the Monroe Doctrine looked southward into and beyond the Caribbean. Issued in 1823, when the countries of Latin America were winning independence from Spanish control, the Monroe Doctrine made plain to European nations that the United States considered Latin America its sphere of influence. Not long after, some Americans began thinking into the Pacific of Hawaii, Japan, and the great markets of China." And that was a quote by Howard Zinn. The mid-19th century term manifest destiny was the belief that the United States was destined to extend its territory to the Pacific Ocean via railroad building, wagon trains, subjugation of Native Americans, wars with Mexico, and whatever else was required to extend our political, social, and economic influence. And Frederick Jackson Turner issued his Frontier Thesis in 1890, a year after the Oklahoma land rush and 3 years after the massacre at Wounded Knee, declaring that the frontier was closed. It wasn't. During the McKinley presidency, 1897 to 1901, Americans experienced what one Washington Post editorial characterized as a new consciousness, and, quote, "with it a new appetite, the yearning to show our great strength," unquote. Ambition, land hunger, pride, trade opportunities, the mere joy of battle, and other motives animated a new sensation in Americans about to come face to face with a strange destiny. Leading the charge into that robust imperialism was robustly masculine Teddy Roosevelt, ever contemptuous of races and nations he considered inferior. Anti-imperialists like William Jennings Bryan, Carl Schurz, Mark Twain, Ambrose Bierce, Booker T. Washington, and John Sherman, brother of General William Tecumseh Sherman, decried Roosevelt's insistence that resistance must be stamped out. Yet, insisted Roosevelt, the first and all-important work to be done is to establish the supremacy of our flag. Philosopher William James, one of the leading anti-imperialists, wrote that Roosevelt, quote, gushes over war as the ideal condition of human society for the manly strenuousness which it involves, and treats peace as a condition of blubber-like and swollen ignobility, fit only for huckstering weaklings dwelling in gray twilight and heedless of the higher life, unquote. Seems my presidential hero, Teddy Roosevelt, was a bit tarnished. But T.R. was backed by enthusiastic advocates of imperialism like Massachusetts U.S. Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, consummate Yale journalist William Randolph Hearst, and a bevy of influential congressmen who assumed that their little brown brothers needed civilizing, even if that required some splendid little wars, as depicted by McKinley Secretary of State John Hay. Yet it was front porch campaigner William McKinley, Roosevelt's predecessor, who aired the principles that seemed to have guided U.S. foreign policy through much of the 20th century, despite protests of isolationists. McKinley declared, "The United States never goes abroad in search of selfish advantage. It seeks only to help less fortunate peoples, even if they cannot understand that they are being helped. And it, the U.S., always acts in accordance with noble ideals." That is a jaw-dropping description of American imperialism, cloaked in the language of liberty. We call upon heaven to witness our great, unselfish, and that's a quote, desire to help our neighbors, but always end up stealing their spoons. So early 20th century imperialists vehemently pushed for peace treaties that would net the United States the islands of Puerto Rico, Guam, and for a mere $20 million, the Philippines, who in a matter of weeks rebelled against U.S. troops in a horrific guerrilla war that lasted 3 years. So much for civilizing and bringing democracy and the spirit of liberty to our fellow earthly residents. In 1796, George Washington issued his 32-page farewell address, urging peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. We should have heeded that good advice from our first president. Now, 18 years into the 21st century, I'm wondering why we're still in Iraq and Afghanistan, and why we occupied those countries in the first place. I suspect it wasn't really to liberate them or to democratize them. Actor Richard Widmark, portraying Colonel Tad Lawson in the film Judgment at Nuremberg, said, "You know, there's one thing about Americans. We're not cut out to be occupiers. We're new at it and not very good at it." How true. I believe 21st century U.S. foreign policy continues to represent itself as benevolent while doing so for its own economic self-interest. And I'm also convinced that any nation can lose its virtue when repeatedly attacking other nations, especially when the attacking rich nation wraps itself in a mantle of self-righteousness while stealing the spoons. And that was Robert Brake with Stealing the Spoons. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake also, The White Man's Burden. In February 1899, British poet Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem entitled The White Man's Burden, urging the United States to take up the burden, quote unquote, of empire. Here is a small portion of that racialized notion, quote, "Take up the white man's burden and reap his old reward, the blame of those ye better, the hate of those ye guard," unquote. White supremacy today is the racist belief that white people are superior in many ways to people of other races, and that white people should be dominant over other races. Relying on pseudoscientific arguments, groups like the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, racist skinheads, neo-Confederates, and Christian Identity, among others, are struggling to sustain a political ideology that perpetuates and maintains the social, political, historical, and institutional domination by white people. Today, it seems that hell hath no fury like a white man scorned. If you take away nothing else from the recent Senate confirmation of Supreme Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh, know that the angry hysterics of Lindsey Graham, Charles Grassley, and Orrin Hatch were little more than a continuation of the long, howling tantrum that started when Donald Trump descended from his tower in 2015, denigrating Hispanics as rapists and criminals. That's the same frustrated rage spewed out of Fox News nightly, and the rage that erupted into deadly violence in Charlottesville. It's the frightened cry of power, shocked to find itself suddenly unsure. For decades, from left to the right, we've told ourselves that our most bitter conflict is conservative versus liberal or free enterprise versus big government. But maybe we should be more honest about the real point of contention. We are, as we have always been, a nation divided on the topic of white male power. It's easy to get confused by the cross currents of misogyny, racism, and xenophobia, believing they are discrete issues rather than the interlocking tools of white men's minority rule. White male power has long relied on the veneer of democracy and law to preserve its control. Take a close look at the U.S. Supreme Court. Was the court legitimate when it affirmed that Negroes were not citizens in the infamous 1857 Dred Scott decision? Didn't the court lose some credibility in the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson separate but equal decision, explicitly welcoming Jim Crow? Our current court is the same institution that has affirmed that money is speech, corporations are people, and women need not be guaranteed equal pay. More significantly, in the aftermath of the 2018 midterm elections, the 2013 court in Shelby County versus Holder gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act based on the straight-faced assertion that racism no longer impacts our elections. In Section 5 of the 1965 Act, states with histories of racial discrimination had to seek federal government approval before changing its voting laws. That is no longer the case, as evidenced by states like North Carolina and Texas, governed by Republicans, passing now disputed laws curbing early voting, requiring people, mostly minorities, to provide identification at the polls, and prohibiting pre-registration for people under 18. In my opinion, that's a blatant disregard of American history. Since 1776, only 2.7% of our congressional representatives have been women. Only 10 black people have ever served in the prestigious U.S. Senate, and we went nearly a century with zero black senators. A black woman didn't enter the Senate chamber until 1993. Just one more has entered since then. Nor has there ever been a Republican woman on the Senate Judiciary Committee. 86-year-old Chairman Chuck Grassley offered a reason for that fact. Quote, it's a lot of work. Maybe they don't want to do it. Unquote. Somehow it has escaped Grassley that his Democratic counterpart, Dianne Feinstein, is a woman. Or maybe he's just trying to forget because he's frightened. Sometimes I marvel at how little it takes to make a powerful white man feel like he's in danger. Noticing the ever-changing demographics, white men are looking around. In the Obama era, they watched the Dreamers discard the white man's idea of citizenship and demand a fundamentally new conversation about immigrant rights. They watched black people build a movement on an irrefutable statement of self-worth, one that requires no white person's approval to be true and potent. And now they're watching as millions of women refuse to carry the shame of their male predators. So it's no wonder that these white men thrash and howl with defensive rage, clinging to the racist views of the president. Good. Let them be afraid. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. And now, as epilogue, on New Year's Day 2019, I will have been an economic exile from Astoria for 4 years, which is equivalent to a military enlistment or a presidential term. I was evicted because the landlord of the house I lived in sold it during the gentrification tsunami that swept over Astoria. The sad irony is that my landlord died the same day I was evicted. I consider Donald Trump the godfather of the real estate racket, and I dedicate today's program to the world's homeless and refugees, and especially in memory of the two immigrant children who recently died seeking refuge in the United States of America. This is Michael McCusker. Happy New Year.